You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Basically, I'm here to tell you what you all know perfectly well. And if I asked you which country in the rich developed world has more obesity than you do, more violence, bigger prison populations, more teenage births, more violence, you all know that the US does. And if I ask you which have less, and in the rich developed world, you know that the Scandinavian countries and Japan do better on all those kinds of things. And if also I ask you about, that intuition that people have had for hundreds of years since the French Revolution or before, that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. So many of us have that intuition. And basically that's all the data says. The only thing I'm going to do is to show you how close that pattern of health and social problems internationally fits the amount of inequality in each society. I mean, basically, all it shows is that intuition is right. It's truer than I think, certainly than I ever imagined. It's profoundly true. But the point about this is, I'm going to show you that one problem after another is more common in more unequal societies. Our book is sometimes called A Theory of Everything because we deal with drug problems and prison populations and, as I said, teenage birth rates and mental illness and, so people say it's a theory of everything. It's actually a theory of problems with social gradients. And, of course, you can look at social gradients, the tendency for all sorts of problems to be more common at the bottom of the social ladder. And you can imagine that maybe that's the problem getting sorted out. Maybe the resilient move up and the vulnerable move down, and that's why all these things have social gradients. However perfectly you sorted the population out according to vulnerability or whatever, you wouldn't get 10 times as much of these problems in some societies as others. And most of what I'm going to show you, the problems are anything from twice as common to 10 times as common in societies with bigger income differences. And that's because it's not simply the poor who are affected by greater inequality. It's pretty well the whole population. I'm going to start, though, with this... I hope this is what I think it is. Yes, is that? Yeah, that's a little red spot. Good. And this, you see, is just national income in relation to life expectancy. And what you see is very rapid rises in the early stages of economic growth. Life expectancy improves fast, and then it sort of levels out. And the interesting thing is, if you look at measures of happiness or well-being, you get pretty much the same shape. Rapid improvements early in economic growth and then gradually flattening out. I started off, actually, my first degree was economic history, and it seems inevitable that as societies get richer, maybe diminishing returns will set in somewhere at some time. Economic growth is really important when people haven't got basic necessities, but it's less and less important as we get more and more. More and more of everything makes less and less difference. And that's basically what this curve is. And life expectancy goes on increasing, but that's because that curve moves up over time, not because we move out along a given one. I'm going to be talking, though, just about these rich countries up here on the flat part of the curve. We did that because we were trying to write a really simple, popular book, and we didn't want to have to control for the effects of GNP per capita, a log-linear relationship, and have to explain what that means and so on. So we just took the rich developed countries up there. And if I move to the next slide, that's just that little bit of the last graph blown up, so you can see it bigger. Can you from the back mostly see the names of these countries, or are they too small? You can see them, okay. So I don't have to read them. And you see that some of these countries on the right, Norway and USA, are twice as rich as Israel, Greece, and Portugal. And currencies are converted to reflect prices, so people in those countries can buy twice as much of everything as people in those countries. And it doesn't make any difference at all. And yet probably all of you know that health is worst in the poorest areas of our societies. Indeed, these social gradients in health, which are, where Clyde's interests and my interests started off, trying to understand what drives these social gradients in health. I'm sorry this is data from England and Wales, but it really looks rather similar wherever you get it from. But you see, on the right-hand side, you've got, this is all small areas, classified by levels of deprivation. The most deprived areas on the right with low life expectancy, the least deprived areas with high life expectancy. You know, it seems to me that those differences in life expectancy related to where you are in society looks to me like the greatest human rights abuse in modern societies. It's not a difference between the poor and the rest of societies. All of us are part of this gradient. But it's a paradox that income or something seems very important within our societies, but it doesn't mean anything between the rich developed countries. And of course the answer, the explanation of that paradox is within societies we're dealing with social position, social status, where we are in relation to each other, the size of the differences between us. And all I'm going to do is to suggest what happens when you stretch out those differences or compress them a bit. I may say, I should have said, showing you the last graph, you know, the fact that we've got to the flat part of that first curve I showed you, I think we are the first generation to have got to the end of the real important social benefits of economic growth. You know, it's transformed human life, but we're now at the end of it. And it's really important to recognize that when you think about sustainability and reducing carbon emissions, because I think everyone thinks it would be an enormous sacrifice to have to reduce carbon emissions and rein in economic growth. That's just not true. We've got to the end of those benefits. I'm going to talk a lot about equality and inequality, and I'm never talking about anything hypothetical. You know, I don't know perfectly equal societies, and fortunately I don't think we know perfect tyrannies either. But the measure of inequality we've used is just how much richer the richest 20% than the poorest 20% in each country. We chose that measure because we could download it from the UN or the World Bank, and so nobody would think we'd manufactured the figures, and it's easy to understand. But anyway, on that measure, you see, in the more equal countries, Japan, Finland, Norway, Sweden, the richest 20% is only 3.5 or 4 times as rich as the poorest 20%. Yet look at that end, and the gap's twice as big. In countries like UK, Portugal, USA, the Guardian newspaper did this coloured version. I've never got into doing very pretty slides. They left off Singapore, which I think the ninefold difference is, so it should come at the end. But anyway, some societies, amongst the rich market democracies, which we all think are much of a muchness, are twice as unequal as others on that measure. Canada, you see, in the middle, but actually you've been moving rapidly in the wrong direction. Your income differences have really taken off recently. And I'm told you're getting more unequal faster than most other OECD countries. Actually, this data is quite old. We'd spent a year writing the book. The publisher sat on it for a year. But even when we collected the data, we got it from UN Human Development Report, and by then it was several years out of date. So you've moved quite a bit in the wrong direction since then. So I'm afraid you shouldn't be too comforted by being in the middle on this data. I said that this was really about problems that have social gradients, and it's a theory of problems with social gradients. And we're preoccupied with these things all the time. And, you know, if I'd lived in the 19th century and somebody had said, had been able to forecast the modern standards of comfort and luxury across such a large proportion of the population, I'd think we would have been in some kind of utopia. Instead of finding that in many countries mental illness is becoming increasingly common, and I don't know about here, but at home you see reports of the levels of self-harm amongst teenage girls and things like that. I mean, simply appalling scale of problems. And everyone worrying about drugs and violence and antisocial behaviour and so on. And this is just one magazine reflecting that. The middle one is prison overcrowding. Our prisons got fuller than they've ever been about a year ago. Anyway, we collected internationally comparable data on as many of these kinds of problems as we could. We collected data on life expectancy for each country, maths and literacy scores of young people, infant mortality, homicide rates, imprisonment — that's simply the proportion of the population in prison in each country — and teenage birth rates, levels of trust, which is simply how much people feel they can trust others in society, obesity rates, mental illness, which in these WHO figures include drug and alcohol addiction, and some figures on social mobility that allow us to compare, you know, social mobility in different countries. Here we've put them all together in a sort of rag bag index of health and social problems. And they're all weighted equally. So where a country is just its average position on these things, affected just as much by obesity as homicides or any of the others. And here you see how well or badly countries do in relation to the measure of inequality I've just shown you. It's really an astonishingly close relationship. But if you look at that same index here in relation to national income per person, there's no relationship. You might think there's a sort of downward drift like that, but that's only because of Portugal there. If you forget Portugal and remember USA up there, you'll see why there's no correlation. We were worried that people would think we'd chosen problems to suit our argument, and indeed, of course, people have accused us of that. But actually, you see, in this list are most of the things with social gradients that you'd expect to find internationally comparable data for. But still, we decided to look at the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing. It's a measure of child wellbeing put together to measure child wellbeing in rich countries. It has 40 different components. So, you know, whether kids can talk to their parents, whether there's bullying at school, whether kids have books at home, what immunization rates are like, all that goes into it. One of the measures that goes into it actually is the proportion of kids in each country in relative poverty. That's very like a measure of inequality, so we took that out so people wouldn't say this is a circular argument. Here is that UNICEF index of child well-being in relation to the same. I'm going to show lots of graphs, and it's always the same measures of inequality along the bottom, with the high inequality on that end, and kids doing worse in those countries. Highly significant relationship. But again, look at this index of child well-being in relation to national income per person, and there's no relationship. So countries can be twice as rich as others, and it doesn't help children one little bit. You know, I get quite impatient with the children's charities at home that go on talking about child poverty without differentiating between relative and absolute poverty. And that makes it uncontroversial politically, so people on one side of the political divide can think, what we need is more economic growth, more incentives to industry, reduce corporation tax, and children will benefit. That's just not true. It's a matter of how far behind the rest of us children are and how unequal a society they're growing up in is. I'm going to show you now some of the separate components of our index. I could show you many more than I have time to. But this one is trust, simply the proportion of the population who feel that most people can be trusted. And I don't know what people here would say, but you see, in the more unequal countries, like Portugal and Singapore, it's only about 15% of the population who feel they can trust others. But at the more equal end, it's 60 or 65%. If I showed you measures of involvement in community life or social capital, very similar relationships. A And so, you know, I think that's the that's an important confirmation of the truth of the intuition that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. It actually damages the quality of social relations in a society, just as people have always imagined. But, you know, it really makes a difference to the quality of life. I think if you've got to walk home alone at night in any of these, in any big city, you'd be much happier and more at ease doing it in some of those Nordic countries than in some of the more unequal countries. I may say we did all this work twice. We did it on the rich developed countries, and then we repeated it on the 50 American states, asking just the same question. Do the more unequal American states have bigger income differences? Sorry, that's not what we were doing. We were looking to see whether the American states with bigger income differences did worse on all these sort of health and social problems. The picture is remarkably similar. Almost everything that is significantly related to inequality internationally is also related to inequality amongst the American states. There are a few exceptions, and we show the data on each of these things in our book, and we also try and show suggest the likely causal pathways. But just to show you how similar the picture is, here is the same measure of trust amongst the American states. It's a very similar scatter. It goes over a very similar range. It doesn't fall quite as low, but it goes up to 60 or 65%. You know, this isn't just a fluke to do with one set of countries. So, let's look at some of the other things. This is mental illness. This isn't people coming into their GP and saying they're depressed or can't sleep or something, which may vary depending on, you know, access to healthcare and so on. This is the World Health Organization giving the same diagnostic interviews to random samples of the population in each country, so we can compare levels of mental illness in each country. And up the side, you've got the proportion of the population who had any mental illness in the preceding year. Most of it probably things like anxiety and depression and so on, but look at the scale of the differences. At the bottom here, more equal countries, you've got maybe 8% of the population had some mental illness in the preceding year. And presumably most of them not very serious mental illnesses, but actually they have a measure of serious mental illness as well, which is also significantly related to inequality. But anyway, look at the more unequal countries. The rates are three times as high. Three times the population prevalence of mental illness. And it's just mind-boggling in a way. This is infant mortality. Quite big differences, I suppose, about twofold. But actually, that regression line, the line of best fit, you can see it should be steeper. It's being pulled down by Singapore here, that claims the lowest infant mortality in the world. I was always very suspicious of that figure. I didn't really believe it. But WHO gives that figure. That's what Singapore report to WHO, and so it goes in. I emphasize this because we've been accused of manufacturing this evidence, of picking and choosing data. We never do that. You know, if there's a data point in our source for one of the countries we're looking at, it goes in, even if I think it's rubbish, because I can't afford to be accused of picking and choosing. I mean, it'd just be silly to manufacture the evidence like that. And actually, I've recently been to Singapore and discovered some of the rather artifactual explanations of why they appear to have such low infant mortality. But anyway, let's move on. This is data from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. They have separate survey data for use of opiates, cocaine, cannabis, ecstasy, and amphetamines. We put them all together in one index, and again, a highly significant relationship with inequality. People sometimes say, oh, they don't, you know, if statisticians complain that we don't put the data up the side on some of these. We do put the data up the side when it's easy to understand, but whenever there's an index, the units are things called standard deviation units, which most people don't understand, so we just say high and low. where have we got to here? Teenage birth rates. These are teenage births per 1,000 women in their teens. The scale of differences is very marked again. Goes from about 5 births per 1,000 teenage women. In Canada, you have 4 times that rate. In Britain, we have 6 times that rate. And in USA, they have over 10 times that rate. Absolutely vast. I once worked in health promotion for a few years in the health service in Bristol. We would have been so thrilled if we could have made a 10% or 20% reduction in any problem. And we're talking about all these huge differences. This one is violence. I chose to show you this one partly because it's produced by Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, who at McMaster. Well, Margot died recently, but they added in... These dots are American states, and the little triangles are Canadian provinces. You're, as you'll be glad to know, more equal than the United States and lower mortality, so you come on the bottom left. But look once more at the scale of the differences. You've got 15 homicides per million. Well, some of your provinces are substantially below that, but 15 would be middle between 0 and 30. And it goes up to 150. Tenfold differences in homicide. The differences in our book, and what we do is not pick out the most dramatic examples from the literature and show them. What we've done instead is to show for the same group of countries with the same measure of inequality, every single health and social problem panning out like this. And what our critics, we've recently been attempts to mug us by organisations like the Taxpayers Alliance. And what they do is they look at our graph, for instance, of homicide, and they say, take off these few points and the relationship isn't significant anymore. And I say, so what? There are 50 papers showing the relationship between violence and inequality in different settings. On health, health is one of the weakest relationships I've in this sort of data, particularly life expectancy and inequality. It's statistically significant, but it's very weak. And, of course, again, they do the same thing. They pull off a few points. They suggest we're the only people who've ever suggested anything as silly as the idea that inequality does any harm to a society. But there are now 200 research papers on income inequality and health in different settings. And so, if you know, they destroy the relationship in our book by picking off a couple of countries. I want to show them the paper on health and inequality in the provinces of China and say, which ones do you want to take off to get rid of the relationship there? And it really is, well, it's silly, but actually it's very annoying. this is prisoners. Proportion of the people locked up in different countries. Prisoners per 100,000 population. This is on a log scale, which means the difference between 1 and 10 is the same as from 10 to 100 and so on. So it compresses the top. Otherwise, this would go curving up probably off the top. But the scale of the differences again. It's harder with a log scale to judge where 40 might be, but Japan is around 40 per 100,000, and it goes up to 400, well, above in the USA. So that's tenfold differences in the scale of imprisonment, the proportion of the people locked up in each country. And actually, that relationship is not driven mainly by more crime. It's mainly a matter of more punitive sentencing. We found when we were writing that there were over 300 people in prison for life for shoplifting in California on the three strikes and you're out principle. And it's pretty barbaric. And actually, the prison regimes differ. I often say if you've got to go to prison somewhere, go in one of the more equal countries, you'll get some remedial help, whereas if you go in some of the more unequal ones, you'll come out brutalised. You'll get a lot of solitary confinement and so on. I think after all that serious stuff, I should tell you at least how Kate tries to liven it up a bit, that Greece shouldn't be quite as low as that, but two of their prisoners escaped recently. And that's not the joke, that's not the joke. The joke is, well, you have to wait. A helicopter landed in the prison yard, two of them got in and it flew away, and it made the newspapers in England because it was the second time they'd done it. They had a very loyal friend with a helicopter. So if you go into prison, you better butter up somebody with a helicopter. What do we got next? Oh yes, social mobility. This is an important one, although there are rather few points. When we first published it, we actually had even fewer data points. But what it's suggesting is that in the more unequal countries, social mobility is lower. The measure they use is income mobility, so I'm afraid it's all very male. It's comparing fathers' incomes with sons' incomes, and looking at father's income when the son is born and the son's income 30 years later. And they're asking, do rich fathers have rich sons and poor fathers have poor sons? And of course, if father's income is highly predictive of son's incomes, then you've got low social mobility. you've got low social mobility in the UK and USA. You've got high social mobility in Denmark and Finland. And again, this is Kate's joke. I'm not very good at jokes, but she says if Americans want to live the American dream, they should go to Denmark and Finland. But even when we had fewer data points, we felt fairly confident that the correlation meant something, because we knew that while income differences had widened in Britain and the United States, that social mobility had slowed and residential segregation had increased. And I'm told that in Canada, while your income differences have widened, your social mobility has slowed. I think it makes good sense if you think what's happening. I mean, as the material differences increase, the social distances increase, the feelings of superiority and inferiority to do with social status. And so I think that, you know, in more unequal countries, there's more downward prejudice to struggle against, you know, whether it's class prejudice or prejudice against ethnic minorities, or I think actually prejudice against women too is part of this probably. But the great justification that's always trundled out for big inequalities of outcome is that it's all very fair if, you know, we can get equality of opportunity. And the thing we should concentrate is not reducing inequality of outcome, but to try and make sure everyone has a fair chance in life. What this suggests is that no country ever gets anywhere near equal opportunities, but it suggests it's very much harder if you're in a more unequal society to get anywhere near that. This is rather surprising, I think. I thought it was a really major flaw in my whole argument, and I didn't know how to deal with the evidence, that it really looked as if everyone benefits. But I think it's now easier to understand why, and the data is quite clear. I may say just the size of the differences I've been showing you, you know, 8, 10, well, sometimes only threefold differences in outcomes. You can't explain such big differences just in terms of inequality affecting a poor minority or an ethnic minority or something like that. These differences are so big because most of us are affected. But fortunately, we don't just have to infer from that kind of consideration. There are a number of studies where you can see how people at different points in the social hierarchy do in more and less equal societies. This is one of them. This is very old data. It's when people were trying to compare health inequalities between nations, and some Swedish researchers classified a number of their infant deaths according to our British Registrar General's occupational class classification. And it starts from class one at the top here, professional occupations, directors of larger companies, down through to junior, non-manual, skilled, manual, semi-skilled, and the unskilled manual. And then again, because anachronistically it's a classification by father's occupation, single parents go alone. But you see that Sweden does better than us all the way across the scale. Even at the top, they do better. And there was another paper showing adult mortality with the same pattern. In our book, we show five or six examples of this, sometimes comparing Britain and the States, sometimes comparing different American states, sometimes looking at maths and literacy scores, sometimes looking at health. And the general picture, if one's going to generalize about who benefits from greater equality, I think the closest you can come to an accurate generalization is that it benefits everyone, but benefits the poor most of all. But it's not just actually these fairly simple ways of looking at it that reach these conclusions. People at the Harvard School of Public Health who've done multi-level models and looked to see who benefit have referred to inequality as a general social pollutant because its effects seem to go so far up the income scale. Let me just show you one more example. This is a very old graph, and it's produced by Doug Wilms here in Canada. And it's literacy scores, but instead of classifying kids by social class, as in that last graph, they're classified by years of education of the parents. And so up there on the top right, you've got the kids of well-educated parents nearer the top of society. And even there, it looks as if it's a bit better to be in Sweden than Canada and worst of all to be in the USA. But at the bottom, there are just enormous differences. So the same pattern, this sort of fanning out problems biggest at the bottom. Sorry, I don't mean that. I mean that the inequality makes most difference at the bottom. Let's just go back for a moment to this graph I showed you earlier when we put it all together. And the effect of putting all these problems together is it emphasizes what they have in common in terms of causes. And so what it's telling us in a way is that inequality is a common cause of all these different things. There are, of course, hundreds of other causes of each of them. You know, maths and literacy scores, all sorts of things to do with teaching and schools that influence it. Obesity and, you know, they've all got lots of other causes. It's just that inequality is a major common element in them. But you see in all the graphs I've shown you, it's always the same countries doing badly. It's an embarrassing lecture to give in the US. You have to give fairly strong signals that you're not just being anti-American. And the great relief for me is to show the graph of child well-being, where Britain does even worse than they do. It's always the same countries that do well as on the other end. And so what we're looking at is a general social dysfunction related to inequality. It's not just one or two things that go wrong, it's most things. And indeed, if you're going to try and think up another explanation, you would have to think of something that was a driver of all those things. So you've got to think of something that would plausibly account for obesity rates being higher and homicide rates and things to do with school performance and anything else. And also which was a driver of inequality. Nobody has so far. You might say it's reverse causality, that it's all the problems that create inequality. But actually, the problem with that is, again, you've got to think of a common driver for all those things to start off with. You know, why do they tend to be, all of those things, be worse in some countries and better in others? So I think there really are serious problems in reverse causality, particularly as a lot of child outcomes are part of this, like juvenile obesity, school bullying, juvenile violence. Those won't affect income inequality, and some of the adult outcomes won't either. So it would be, I think, an impossible argument to sustain. I may say also another point important to make at this stage is that, you see, Sweden and Japan do pretty well. But in terms of cultural differences, there are not two more different countries in amongst the OEC lot than those two. I mean, think of the position of women in Sweden and Japan, or how closely they keep to the nuclear family. They're totally different. But also how they get their greater equality is totally different. Sweden has large differences in earnings, and they redistribute with high taxes and benefits, big welfare state. Japan starts off with smaller differences in earnings and has lower taxes and a smaller welfare state. And we find just the same difference amongst some of the American states. In Vermont and New Hampshire, both do pretty well. But Vermont has one of the higher social expenditures amongst American states and higher social and higher taxation. And New Hampshire has the lowest state taxation of any state except Alaska, and lower social expenditure as well. But they do well because their initial earnings differences are small. I don't know why that is, but one of the things I've recently found is that one of the things they do is protect trade union rights. So it is illegal to try and get an employee to sign a contract banning trade union membership. It's also illegal to organise strike breaking. And I have found a couple of papers which suggest that, and on statistical evidence, that trade union movements are stronger in more equal societies. So maybe they have a role to play in this. I should say a little bit about this. I'm probably rather too close to the end of my time. my understanding of these things, or my guesses about what's going on, come from social epidemiology, trying to understand social gradient in health and social determinants of health. And the big change in our understanding, and one where Clyde's work has been really important, is how important the psychosocial mediation is. So it's not simply the bricks and mortar that give you heart disease. It's actually what you feel about being at the bottom, the effects on working through chronic stress. And increasingly people understand the physiological effects of chronic stress on the immune system, the cardiovascular system, and often, I think increasingly, you hear people likening its effects to more rapid aging. It's a powerful physiological influence. But I think the main groups of psychosocial risk factor for poor health that we've become aware of can be grouped in these sort of categories: things to do with low social status, things to do with weak social connections. Almost any measure of social connectedness, whether it's relationships with our partners or how many friends or involvement in community life, all highly protective. Also experimental data that shows that we have higher resistance to infection and wound healing is faster if we have good social relationships. And the other part of this is stress in early life, both maternal stress in pregnancy and things like the quality of early childhood, domestic conflict, poor attachment, things like that, which affect health right into my age and older. A long shadow forwards, people often say. But it seemed to me that maybe there was a common element running through these, that there was a sort of, that maybe the insecurities that go with low social status are rather like the insecurities that that you might have from a difficult early childhood. We talk about insecurity or anxiety or feeling you're not valued. And friendship fits into that pattern, because if you have friends, you know, they're people who like you, you feel better, but you get positive feedback from your friends. You feel, oh, I'm all right. You know, they like my company. But if you feel people avoid you, you're excluded, people don't want your company, we all very quickly have that sense of vulnerability, of fearing that we're unattractive, we're boring, whatever it is. And actually, for you see, what this is about is really our susceptibility to emotions like shame and embarrassment. A psychologist, Thomas Scheff, calls shame and embarrassment the social emotions because they are what makes us conform. And you see, in a creature like human beings that depends on a learned cultural way of life rather than on instinctively programmed behaviour, how we learn to behave in acceptable ways is by being susceptible to each other's eyes, experiencing ourselves through each other's eyes. And you know, when people do something awful in front of other people, they say, I just wish the ground would have swallowed me up. Because, you see, you are the bearers of culture. And for me to learn to behave in acceptable ways, I have to be sensitive to your judgments. And so part of being a human being is to be sensitive to shame and embarrassment and our worries about being looked down on and other people's judgments of us. And those are heightened in a modern mass society where we're meeting new people all the time instead of being embedded, as we were only a generation or two ago, in fairly stable communities. You know, I remember meeting people who'd never been out of their hometown in the 1950s. So I suspect that what we're dealing with is that sort of difficulty, worries about self-presentation, how we're judged, how we're seen, and need to keep up appearances and so on. I developed that kind of explanation when I found a meta-analysis of 208 studies of experiments where people had been invited into a psychological laboratory and given nasty, stressful things to do while having their cortisol. Cortisol is one of the central stress hormones measured, so they were interested in seeing how much cortisol went up when people were doing these nasty tasks. And the meta-analysis reviewing all these studies was really interested in what kind of tasks most reliably push up cortisol levels. And what they found was it was tasks that included social evaluative threat, threats to self-esteem or social status in which others can judge you negatively. And that's a quote from the paper. Those are the sort of things that get to us, which get under the skin, very much confirming the sort of interpretation I was giving you about how all those things come together. It's also why violence is more common in more unequal societies. It's not simply the rich attacking the poor. The poor attacking the rich. Actually, inequality you could regard as the rich attacking the poor. But this is a prison psychiatrist who says, I have yet to see a serious act of violence in the second paragraph that was not provoked by the experience of feeling shamed and humiliated, disrespected and ridiculed. And it's because violence is triggered by people feeling humiliated, disrespected. Very much the same ballpark as what I was talking about. But another pattern, I think, is part of this. This is, rather old data, but it illustrates it well, and it's nice to have, and when I'm talking to economists, it's very nice to have a study that comes from people at the World Bank. I sometimes feel that's all that some economists will respect. This is an experiment, I heard a growl. This is an experiment in which kids are asked to do mazes, finding their way into the centre on pieces of paper, and the question is how many can they do in a given time. They're high and low caste children in India, from Indian villages. And when they don't know each other's caste, they do them equally well. But when they do know who are the high caste and who are the low caste kids, suddenly performance in the low caste drops off. And there are just lots of these are called stereotype threat experiments. They've been done hundreds of times in different contexts. You can do it with men and women. You give them, I don't know, mathematical or spatial things to do, and women do them pretty well as well. And except when you say, women are often thought to be less good at this kind of thing than men, and then the women's performance, or with ethnicity in the States. You give a test and you say, this is not a test of cognitive ability. And black students do as well as the white ones. But if you say, this is a test of cognitive ability, black performance falls off. So we're highly sensitive to these crude social stereotypes. And indeed, I think it's really important to think about that in relation to how early the signs of school failure kick in kids. And I've met people who just felt the whole of their educational experience was being taught how hopeless they were, and are so phobic about school that they won't, as adults, even walk down the street where their school was. You know, that sort of pain. I would like to spend time telling you about how this relates to moving towards sustainability, because I think what we've got to do is put together a picture of the future society we need to move towards, not only with greater equality, but also reducing carbon emissions and so on. And one of the things, of course, is that consumerism is the greatest threat to getting anywhere near sustainability. But it's driven, a substantial part of the driver for consumerism is status competition. And that's amplified, intensified by inequality. And in more unequal societies, as you see here, people work longer hours. They also save less of their income. They spend more. They get into debt more. And that's because money matters even more in those societies. It's how you show what you're worth. But also, more equal societies are more public-spirited because there's more involvement in community life, higher levels of trust. People are more aware of the common good. And, of course, reducing carbon emissions is going to depend on being aware of the common good on a worldwide scale. And this is shows more equal societies are better at recycling. This shows that business leaders in more equal societies think it's more important that their governments should abide by international environmental agreements. Because, of course, in more equal societies, everyone knows you have to fend for yourself and damn the others. I think the take-home message is that we must stop thinking about now about the progress, about improving the quality of life through economic growth, through consumerism stuff. We've got to the end of that. It's a zero-sum game. I mean, of course, we can improve our lot if we move up in our existing society, but everyone moves up together. There's no net benefit to the society. And the way we should now be improving the real social quality, the real quality of life, is by improving the quality of social relations. And it was very sad, that very good book on happiness, Richard Layard, book on happiness, he ends up by saying the solution is that we should all go and have cognitive behavioral therapy. And actually, he's managed to get much more of it provided by the government because of that. But actually, what this data is telling us, I think, is if we reduce the scale of inequality, we improve the psychosocial well-being of the whole society. Thank you.